You're listening to Find Your Voice, a podcast made in collaboration with the independent federal member for Goldstein, Zoe Daniel. This podcast is recorded on the traditional land of the Bunurong people of the Kulin Nation.
Well, hello everyone and welcome to Find Your Voice. My name is Zoe Daniel and this is a podcast where we host in-depth conversations about policy and issues affecting both my electorate of Goldstein and wider Australia. I'd like to begin by acknowledging the traditional owners of the lands on which this podcast is being recorded, the Boonwurrung peoples of the Kulin Nation, and their elders past and present on unceded Aboriginal land. Today, I'm joined by Cathy Kaplan OAM, a woman who has dedicated her life to protecting and empowering others. Cathy's the daughter of a Holocaust survivor and the founder of Impact for Women, a completely volunteer charity based in Goldstein and committed to making a difference to Victorian women and children fleeing extreme violence at home. A breast cancer survivor, Cathy is also a passionate advocate for breast cancer research and for supporting young single mums facing their breast cancer journey. In 2011, Cathy was awarded an OAM for her work in the area of domestic violence and also for her work in the Jewish community. And in October 2015, Cathy was honoured with the prestigious Ron Caston Humanitarian Award for Lifetime Achievement. Hi, Cathy. It is so great to have you.
Hi, Zoe. Pleasure to be speaking with you.
Now, we're going to get into a pretty difficult and challenging subject today, and that is domestic and family violence in Australia. This is an area where you've been working on the front line for a long time. As a policymaker now, I'm really interested in your views on what are the core pieces or indeed the missing pieces in this picture that need urgent attention. What comes to mind?
I can give four things that I would really encourage our governments to look at, whether they're state or federal. We need to have much stronger policies about protection orders and how they're policed so that then people are mandatorily punished, if you like, for want of a better word, when they breach them. We need mandatory sentencing laws. We need mandatory requirements for perpetrators to attend counselling sessions and behavioural modification sessions. And we need for the courts and the police to have much stronger powers than they've got now because they're very curtailed.
Tell me about the work of Impact. I think it would be really useful for our audience, and even people in the electorate of Goldstein might not know what you do, and it is amazing work. Just paint us a picture of what Impact does.
Thank you. Look, we're a completely volunteer organisation. We don't deal with the women face-to-face, although a lot of them then self-identify to us. We work with the agencies that are tasked and funded to care for women who've had to escape extreme violence at home. What we do is provide services and gifts that are practical, grassroots, and plain bloody common sense. So our flagship program is our Bags of Love, which currently we distribute twice a year in time for Mother's Day and in time for Christmas, although we're now looking at maybe making that a more frequent delivery process. Currently, we're now sending out 2,500 bags on each of those occasions. A bag is a large supermarket-sized canvas bag, and everything in it is new, and that's really important to us. While we're a charity, we don't want our recipients to feel as if they're charity cases from us. So everybody gets basic necessities, but also some things that they might want, because wants are important as well. So everybody gets basic hygiene products. When you run for your life with nothing except your life and your children's lives in your hands, you don't think about picking up a toothbrush or a toothpaste or a hairbrush. So we provide all of those basics. We provide makeup when we can get enough donations for that. I used to think that that was a nice add-on extra. But just before COVID, when we thought we were big and only doing 1,000 bags at a time instead of 2,500, we had the bags laid out, ready to be filled by our volunteers. Now, volunteers were coming in. And I have to tell you, 1,000 bags covers 1.5 basketball courts. It's big. So you can imagine how many 2,500 is. a woman came in and burst into tears. Now, it was pre-COVID, so I could go up to her quite happily and give her a hug and console her. And she said, I didn't know there were so many of us. So we started talking, and then I asked her, give me some feedback. What did you like? What didn't you like? And she said, there were two things that I really liked. There was one thing I needed. That was the hygiene. What I really liked, though, was the chocolate. There was chocolate. There's never such a thing as too much chocolate. And the other thing, she said, the makeup. Now, I feel ashamed of what I said next, because without meaning to be nasty about her, she looked like a woman who didn't know what a lipstick was. And I said to her, did it make you feel better? And I should have known the answer before I opened my mouth and said that. And she said, no, Kathy, you missed the point. It hid the bruises. And so I don't see makeup as a frivolous gift anymore. So we give new clothes, new linen, new household products, because when they leave the agency, they've got to start life with nothing. So they're the sorts of things we've been doing. We instigated a free childcare at Moorabbin Court because we heard and learnt that courts didn't have childcare on family violence days. Now, when a woman is put into a refuge, she's put into another part of Victoria. She doesn't know anyone. She probably has no money. Who has cash nowadays anyway? Her credit cards are probably in her partner's name, but even if they're not, the bills go home, so the perpetrator can sort of work out where she is regionally. So how is she going to find or afford childcare? She can't. So she has to bring her toddlers with her. She thinks she's only going to be in court for an hour or so. She ends up there nearly all day. The children are tired, they're bored, they're hungry, they're thirsty, they're tugging at her. Mummy, mummy, mummy. She can't focus on what she needs to focus on. Worse yet, the children have to be re-traumatised, hearing the details of what they've witnessed or experienced or heard themselves. And the alleged perpetrator's just a couple metres away. We thought that was unconscionable. So we approached Moorabbin Court and said, if you give us a room that has direct access to the toilets without going through the waiting room, the general waiting room, we'll set it up with child-friendly furniture and toys, and we'll pay for two qualified childcare workers to staff the room on family violence days. It was a resounding success, and the court asked us for a second day a week. And then COVID hit. And so, of course, at the start of COVID, no court cases were being heard at all. And then the courts discovered something absolutely marvellous. They discovered a technology that's like Zoom, and they started being able to do hearings remotely. They're very forward-thinking, our courts. So they started doing that. But some people still need to be in court in the building. So they took what they'd learnt from remote learning with what they'd learnt from us, and all courts now that do family violence hearings either have it or are in the process of establishing a room where the woman can be and see into the court, but the court can't see, the alleged perpetrator can't see her, and they've set up child-friendly play area for the children. So we no longer have to do the free court childcare program, and I'm really, really pleased about it. We stopped not because it failed, we stopped because it was actually successful.
And the court example is just a sort of extension of the kind of practical thinking that the Bags of Love originate from, which is built on very direct and practical need. And I love both of those examples.
I'm a bit of a bulldog with a bone. So with the court situation, I was talking to every politician I could find, including you, about it. And towards the end, I was starting getting a bit cross, and I was saying, look, we have very strict child safety standards in schools, in churches, in synagogues, mosques, community places. Why aren't those same levels of child safety in our courts? And I think now there are, so that's good. But I don't think they were originally.
Tell me, before we sort of move on to some of the broader, bigger picture issues around family violence, I just want to delve a little further into your motivations. What triggered you to start Impact for Women?
It was an accident, Zoe. So back in 2006, I've been a single mum since my children were 5, 3, and 8 weeks old. But in 2006, they were young teenagers. I was working very full-time to support them. I was the president of a large communal organisation and my term came to an end. And everyone knows it only takes you 5 minutes a week to run an organisation, so I had 5 spare minutes up my sleeve. It was coming up to Mother's Day, and 2006 is pre-social media, so all advertising is on billboards, TV, radio, magazines, etc. And all I could see were images of happy mummies getting electrical appliances and chocolates that we neither need nor want. And it occurred to me that all of this positive advertising was actually having a negative impact on those of us who've been in difficult situations, because we've been taught to believe that we're unlovable, that we're not worthy of anything, and that we really don't deserve a place on this world. So I thought, well, wouldn't it be nice if we can give the women in hiding a token gift that just for half a second they think a stranger recognises that I'm alive and that I'm worthwhile. So I did some research, some really poor research as it turns out, and I thought there were 100 Victorian women in hiding on any given night. We now know that there are at least 2,500 women in hiding on any given night and their children, and that does not include those who are with their family and friends, couch surfing, sleeping in their cars or doing it rough. So we gave out those 100 little gift boxes, and chip chop, job done, Kathy, that's it, move on to something else. And then I got some thank you notes. And the thank you note that still kicks me in my belly is the one that told me that was the first ever Mother's Day gift she had that did not include a black eye. And so Impact was born, and we just grew like Topsy through word of mouth. Last year we had nearly 2,000 volunteers helping us, and we positively impacted the lives of more than 5,000 women and their children. And I think that's pretty good.
It is very good. And I highly recommend anyone who has the time to dedicate some of it to volunteering. There is something incredibly uplifting about the scene in that warehouse with all of those red bags full of goodies that are going to women and children who really need them. Kathy, I want to go to the link between family and domestic violence and women's economic insecurity. One of my big policy focus areas is economic empowerment of women, and there's a whole range of elements under that. I'm curious what link or patterns you see between those two things.
Oh, huge. Firstly, financial abuse is really significant. You know, we have women in hiding who are from affluent families, but everything is in the perpetrator's name. So she has nothing and no skills to deal with nothing because she's never had to. So there's a major problem. But financial literacy, it's still really poorly taught, if it's taught at all. And I think even though we're a much more equal society, there's still a huge disparity and still a lot of gender differences. And in many families and partnerships, it's the he who does the finances and the she who does everything else. I remember, was it Albert Schweitzer who once said the secret to his long marriage was they agreed that he would make all the important decisions in life and his wife would make all the others. And he's very grateful there were no major decisions to be made.
Yeah, well, I mean, it kind of leads me to my next point, which is, you know, we know that this is happening. I mean, in Goldstein, for example, family violence is 50% of the police caseload. So that speaks to exactly what you're talking about, that it doesn't discriminate by postcode and affects people in all sorts of different ways. And financial coercive control is often a factor, if not, as you say, inability or lack of knowledge in managing our own finances. And you'll be happy to know that I'm in direct conversations with various ministers in the government about financial literacy education, because I think that is an enormous piece of it. But what do you think the disconnect is between sort of knowing all of this, but then actually I guess, recognising and accepting this as a national crisis and creating momentum for the various actions that you mentioned in your first answer. You know, we see women being killed at a rate of more than one a week, and still we're in this sort of collective inertia.
Yeah, we've lost 14 so far, and we're in week 9.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
My answer will sound like it's male bashing, and I don't mean it to sound that way because it's not the intent. But if men were being killed at this rate, something would be done. We saw that 10 years ago with the One Punch Law, when Daniel, I've forgotten his surname, was the 80th man killed by a single punch in 6 years. Within 12 months, we had the One Punch Law and mandatory sentencing of 10 years. Last year, we lost 75 women. 80 men in 6 years, 75 women in 1 year. You can't help but look at that and say, and especially with International Women's Day coming up in 2 days' time, we're still not equal in society. It's not a sexy issue. So a lot of politicians, I don't think, are going to jump on it.
And I agree with you completely that the numbers, if it was happening to men or indeed in any other context, we would say, we have to do something about this, and we would be throwing everything at it. Is it desensitization? Is it inertia? Is it not knowing what to do, how to fix it? Is it failed policy making? I mean, these are big questions, but do you see a way to trigger forward movement?
I know we've got people like you, Zoe, really pushing for it, and that's really, really important. I wish I had a magic bullet. I don't know what the answer is, except that more and more of us have to talk about it. More and more of us have to push the reality onto everybody, but it's our politicians who are the lawmakers. And legislation alone is not going to solve the problem, but legislation and making those four things that I said, you know, legislating them and making them mandatory will help, because we'll be giving strong messages to the community that this sort of behaviour is not okay. And it's not just the bashing and the killing. It's all the other forms of abuse that lead up to it, because you don't fall in love one day and get bashed the next. It starts with very simple microaggressions. And then as they're not having the desired effect of control, they increase. So it then part of the public education that we need to be doing from kindergarten to the grave has to be about that we all have to be upstanders, not bystanders. We can't, the standard we walk past is the standard we accept. If we hear an inappropriate joke, if we hear somebody putting somebody down, we have to say something. All of us. But men have to say it to men too. They will hear it better, unfortunately. We should all be equal. Men should listen to women. Women should listen to men. All genders should listen to all genders. But we still live in a society where we are primarily binary. We are still patriarchal in some sense. And we need to be calling out all of those microaggressions because they escalate.
Could I go to the resourcing issue? And, you know, there's various facets of that, crisis housing, for example, and longer-term housing for women and children, funding for wraparound services and such. How much of the lack of resolution or solution to this is about money?
I think a lot more needs to be invested. It is true that our refuges are far better funded now than they were when we started 18 years ago, but they're still very poorly resourced. They rely on charities. They rely on individuals giving. I understand that no government can fix every social problem, and that's why any charity exists. But I think we need far more. We need more funding for our refuges. We need far more funding for social housing. Domestic violence is the leading cause of homelessness for women and children. We need more wraparound services. We have women and children who are in dire circumstances, not just physically, but emotionally, psychologically, financially, every single way, who don't know that where they're going to be living in a couple of months or a couple of weeks or even a couple of days, who don't know how they're going to feed their children, who have had to leave their jobs because they've had to go to another part of Victoria. Yes, the law does allow for the perpetrator to be evicted from the home, But the reality is the perpetrator knows where the family lives. The perpetrator knows where the children go to school. The perpetrator knows where she works. And the abuse can continue in that sense. So while it's possible to evict the perpetrator, the reality is for most women, it's she and her children who have to leave and go somewhere else. So we need a lot more support for them, a lot more.
Before I close this off, Kathy, as a former journalist, I'm interested in your views about how the media covers family violence and violence against women, and whether you have any reflections on whether changing that would help to change community attitudes and perspectives, and also the bystander effect that I think we're all seeking in terms of people intervening in situations.
Exactly. We saw that last week, didn't we, with the two gentlemen who were killed, and the neighbours heard some strange noises and didn't say anything. We've heard that over and over, but we often don't hear about the murders of women. And when we do, it's often in disparaging ways. In Queensland, we had a woman killed by a tractor and the slasher, and she's the slasher victim, or she was the rubbish bin victim, or pointing out that she was a sex worker, or pointing out that she was, you know, demeaning her. It's not victim blaming her, but it's in a similar vein of putting her down. We hear so often, but he was such an upstanding citizen. Yeah, he was an upstanding citizen. But when you bash your partner, whatever gender your partner is, that doesn't make you a good person. I don't see the media being strong enough or realistic enough. We've seen Jane Hall correcting headlines. You know, she didn't tease him into it or do something. It's still a lot of victim blaming or implied victim blaming. And any violence, any abuse is never the victim's fault. Never, because every form of abuse and every form of violence is a conscious decision. And we all, men and women, all genders, we need to be taught from kindergarten to the grave, reminded on a regular basis that we have to treat people with respect. Doesn't matter who they are, they're worthy of respect.
Kathy, there's some big news this week, which is that you're retiring. And I'm just wondering, well, firstly, how that feels after everything that you've done, and you've achieved so much, there's a lot more to do, but also what hope you feel as you do that, whether the progress that's been made feels like momentum, that the, for example, consent education in schools, increasing awareness among young men and boys, and more open conversations about these kinds of things and everything that we've been talking about, you know, do you step away into a different phase of your life with optimism?
Yes, I'm an optimistic person at heart. I like to believe the best in people. I like to believe that things will get better. And I've just looked up just now, because I read last night a lovely quote about that, about optimism. And it says that optimism is the belief that the world is changing for the better. Hope is the belief that together we can make the world better. And I really believe that. It needs no courage to be an optimist, but it takes a great deal of courage to hope. And I am hopeful. I have to remain hopeful. I have to remain hopeful that we can be better people. We can be a better society. We can be a better world, regardless of what you're looking at, whether you're looking at domestic abuse or climate change. We have to have hope that we can all be better. And all I ask people to do is to give and do whatever it is that they can give and do, because that's how it's going to happen.
Kathy Kaplan, such a joy to have you on the podcast. Thanks so much for your time today.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you, Zoe, and thank you for what you do.
Kathy Kaplan is the founder of The Amazing Impact for Women, and I am so proud to say that Impact for Women is based in my electorate of Goldstein. Please Google. And if you have any time to donate, to volunteer, it will really make a big difference to your life. It's a wonderful scene packing those bags in the warehouse. I will say, if you have been listening to this podcast and you are in immediate danger, please call 000. If you or someone you know is experiencing domestic or family violence, I would also recommend that you call 1-800-RESPECT for 24/7 support. And as always, thank you for listening to Find Your Voice.
You can learn more about Zoe and her work in the Australian Parliament at zoedaniel.com.au. And if you enjoyed this episode, leave a review. We'd love to hear from you. This podcast is authorised by Zoe Daniel, 677 Nepean Highway, Brighton East, Victoria.